This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, we're seeing food riots now in over 30 cities. Just in the last 2 weeks, there have been food riots. Countries all over the world, some major, major problems with food. And there are a lot of theories about what's going on here. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says that biofuels may be contributing as much as 10% to the current price rise. There are those who are suggesting that the deregulation of the commodity markets in the United States in the year 2000, the last year of the Clinton administration, there was this massive deregulation of the commodity markets. What was put in was is sometimes referred to as the Enron loophole. It allowed Enron to essentially manipulate one of the commodities, that being oil or being energy, electricity, fairly massively. There is some concern about individual countries' ability to protect their own commodities. For example, in 1959, this is with oil, Dwight Eisenhower placed an embargo on imported oil into the United States. That stood from 59, from Eisenhower's administration, until 73 when Nixon lifted that. And then Jimmy Carter tried to take us to the point where we weren't importing oil. But the reason I mention oil is because the United Nations also says while biofuels may have as much as 10% to do with the increasing price in food, that the increase in the price of oil accounts for at least 20% of it, because tractors run on oil, fertilizers made out of oil, herbicides and pesticides made out of oil, all those kind of things. Biofuels are only 1.3% of the world's food supply. And then there's another factor here, the Washington Post writing, that mediocre harvests in the United States and Europe and terrible harvests in Australia, probably the result of global warming. So here we've got this perfect storm, this confluence of events, of things that are bringing about potentially a food disaster in the world. What do we do about it? Dr. Yaron Brook is with us. He is the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, the objectivist think tank. Ayn Rand, A-Y-N-R-A-N-D. Of course, she was the author of Atlas Shrugged, the book back in the 50s that kicked off the objectivist movement that provided the inspiration for the modern-day libertarian movement and has, in many ways, become the economic, anyway, mantra of the modern-day conservatives. And I know, Yaron, we always have to put the caveat in that you disavow those guys.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's inspired any of anything to do with conservatives. But
well, you know, Alan Greenspan still quotes Ayn Rand.
Well, he quotes it, but doesn't behave according to her. But, no true objectivist would head the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, you're right. Ayn Rand, by the way, the website, AYNRAND.org. And so, Yaron, what's your take on what's going on here with regard to food?
Well, I think there are four reasons for this. The first has to do with inflation. The fact is that over the last at least 5 years, really, going back into the Greenspan era at the Fed, the U.S. Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply dramatically.
In other words, decreasing the value of the dollar.
Decreasing the value of the dollar and really exporting that inflation. So any country in the world that has its currency tied to the dollar is experiencing inflation today, including
right.
China and many countries in the third world. And therefore, in dollar terms, food prices have gone up dramatically. You can go to the grocery store here in the United States and see it. And, of course, for third-world countries, that increase is dramatic and is causing real problems. These are not fake. These are real problems.
Yeah. So this is an area where I think you and I agree, and it's oddly enough.
Yeah, I think so.
And the solution, I mean, if this is the Fed, I mean, keep in mind, in 1913, when the Fed was brought into being, you could buy a loaf of bread for about 5 cents, and a loaf of bread right now is what, $2?
At least. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the Fed has been a disaster from day one. It caused the Great Depression. It caused the inflation of the 1970s.
I would disagree about the Great Depression.
I know you do, but it caused the recent housing bubble, and I think it caused the Internet bubble. You know, the Fed's policies have been misguided from day one, and I don't blame any particular.
So what do we do? Go back to the Treasury producing currency and say the banking system's on its own? I mean, when we did that throughout the 19th century, we had about every 15, 20 years a bank panic.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's much, much healthier, and I think bank panics would go away if we deregulated appropriately. I believe going back to the days where banks printed currency and private banks on a private gold standard is the best deal. But let me go on to, since we're talking about food, because we could talk the whole time about the Federal Reserve and
sure.
banking.
Yeah.
Second, no question, biofuels,
they're a small
plenty
factor
of evidence. That people are shifting crops away from food and towards ethanol. And ethanol, from every perspective, even if you believe in global warming and the problem of cause, biofuels are not the solution.
I think there's an increasing consensus on that. But Yaron, let's bring this right to the core of this.
Yep. In
the front page of today's Financial Times,
yep.
front page, headline, EU's food policy is the answer to high prices. Africa, and this is Ben Hall writing in Paris, but he's quoting the former foreign minister for the European Union. He says Africa and Latin America should adopt their own versions of Europe's common agricultural policy. Now, as you probably know, the European Union has a very protectionist policy with regard to food.
Yep.
The whole thing is all of the European nations collectively are going to be collectively food independent. Some of them are producers, some are consumers,
yeah.
most are both, you know, in various forms. But collectively they're saying, that's it, we are independent of food, and we're going to protect that market. And here's two quotes from this guy. He said, what we are now witnessing in the world is the consequence of too much free market. And we cannot leave feeding people to the mercy of the market. We need a public policy of means of intervention and stabilization. He said that West Africa, East Africa, Latin America, and the southern shore of the Mediterranean all need regional common agricultural policies. This is verbatim quotes from the former head of the EU's economic systems there. And it seems to make perfect sense to me. You know, let's encourage people to use the power of government to protect themselves rather than throwing this in to the mercy of Archer's Daniel Midland.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's completely wrong. I think that in a sense he's right, and that is that these countries in Africa and in Asia need to start taking care of themselves. But the way to take care of themselves is to encourage more property rights and capitalism in their own countries. What they need to do is to create capital through private ownership of land. What they need to do is create true farmers and to encourage.
Well, arguably what you're suggesting is what Zimbabwe did in Africa. You know,
what Zimbabwe did is
he carved up land and said, here, have some, it's yours.
Well, but they carved up private land. They carved up land that was already very highly utilized for the purposes of farming. Very effective. Zimbabwe
was a huge exporter
of food. And what they did there is they stole the land and gave it to whoever.
But the point is that passing out private property didn't solve the problem. Whereas in Europe, the problem has been solved by good government policy.
Look, stealing private property from one group and handing it to another didn't solve the problem. The solution
right.
is to sell private property to people who are capable of using that private property. And in this case,
but in most of these countries, there's plenty of private property.
No, most of these countries have no recognition of private property. And what they need is to encourage foreign investors. They need to encourage foreign corporations, the evil corporations, to come in and bring
buy up their
farm
property?
Technology, bring their farm technology to bear. What we need is more genetically engineered foods that can resist pesticides and increase their nutritional content.
But you're on in India, where 3-4 years ago Monsanto started selling
yeah.
BT cotton to the farmers there and telling them, sorry, you can't keep your seeds like you always used to. They're now experiencing the highest level of farmer suicides in history because people are being wiped out because they used to have an economy based on saving seeds in a local economy. Now they have to pay to Monsanto.
I don't know where that comes from. But the point is that if Indian farmers use the latest technology, if Indian farmers you know, grew the food that the market values or the products that the market values the highest, they would be making more money.
But Monsanto's not the market. Monsanto's a company that wants profits. And when you bring these large multinationals in, they essentially take over the local agricultural economy. And it no longer works for the local people. It works for the big multinationals.
There should be fewer farmers in India and in these other places, just like the fewer farmers in the United States. I mean, how many?
So we need more major economic elites.
How many people used to produce the food in the United States? It was something like 70% of all Americans were farmers 100 years ago. Today it's 2%, and we produce gazillions more food. That's the kind of economies of scale we need to bring to the rest of the world. We need more capitalism and more trade, not less.
Okay, you can read all about it over at Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org, the website for the Ayn Rand Institute. And Dr. Yaron Brook, the president and executive director. Thanks, Yaron, always for dropping by and talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So here we are back to the, I mean, this is ultimately going to be the conversation that we're going to be having in the fall. And that is the conversation between the conservative right, the hard conservative right, that is represented by John McCain, which suggests that the answer to all things is the free market. And practical experience in the world, in my humble opinion, such as the European Union's very, very successful efforts to maintain food security, that suggests that when we collectively get together, when democracies collectively get together, when we the people get together and do things and do them in a rational fashion that integrates with the market but doesn't allow the market to absolutely control things, then you can have a policy that's actually first and foremost in the interest of the people rather than a small number of large multinational corporations. That's the bottom line. And that's what it's going to come down to. Whether it's Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, when it is the Democrat versus John Dean, it's going to be the people versus the big corporations. That's going to be the debate. Now, speaking of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, yesterday Howard Dean was on Meet the Press, and I think that he made a comment which was ultimately the most important comment. I mean, it was such a forehead slap for me. This was such an important thing. That was probably the most important thing politically that's been said in the last two or three weeks. And let me just share that with you. Here is Howard Dean.
Truth is, we need to figure this out before the convention. We need time to heal. And actually, I'm not the most important person in terms of bringing the party together. The most important person is the person who doesn't win the nomination.
Who doesn't win?
Because I can remember when I lost to John Kerry, I had to go out and convince my supporters, and it took me about 3 months, that they needed to support Senator Kerry. I endorsed him. I campaigned for him. I went to all the college campuses. And that's what the person who doesn't win this with 49% of the delegates is going to have to do in order to keep the party together.
And that's, you know, and I was like, yeah, of course. I mean, you'd say, well, common sense. But this raises the question. Barack Obama, up to this point, has kept his attacks on Hillary Clinton below that threshold, where if he went above that threshold, he would not be able to support her in the general election. In other words, he has not attacked her in ways that could be used, for example, by John McCain. He has not attacked her in ways where he would have to go back and say, you know, I was wrong when I said that, and now I'm changing my mind. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, and again, please understand, I am not being an Obama partisan when I'm saying this. This is an indictment not of Hillary Clinton, but of the way of Mark Penn and what's his name, Wolfson, the guys running her campaign. I think that they are so wrong to be doing this. By saying, for example, that she has experience, John McCain has experience, and Barack Obama has a speech. You know, that's hitting below the belt. How do you then, if she's not the nominee, how do you then do what Howard Dean did, who, by the way, never hit John Kerry below the belt? How do you then go out and engage in a 50-state strategy where you go from state to state and you campaign? How can she campaign for Barack Obama? I think that it's fairly clear that Barack Obama will be able to successfully campaign for Hillary Clinton. Because he hasn't, at least as some people in his campaign certainly have, And there have been some vicious attacks on Hillary Clinton by surrogates, by people associated with the campaign, by partisans, by, you know, just people with bubbling in general and way too much enthusiasm. But it has not come out of the candidate's mouth. And when the candidate says, well, you know, I wouldn't have sat in that church with that pastor, how is she then going to defend Reverend Wright if she's not the nominee? And see, understanding that this is the fundamental dynamic in presidential politics, that the loser in a primary has to become the biggest cheerleader for the winner. Otherwise, the winner will not win the general election. As Howard Dean understood in 2004, and in my opinion, John Kerry did win that election. It was stolen in Ohio, but that's a whole other thing. But nonetheless, to the extent that John Kerry was successful, in large part it was because of Howard Dean. Howard Dean, who himself, by the way, was the victim. Here we have now, down in I believe, South Carolina, you've got these ads which are not even running, have not even run, with, you know, conflating Reverend Wright and Obama with a couple of local candidates and basically trying to say, you know, this guy, speaking of Barack Obama, saying, you know, this guy's blacker than you thought, or this guy's a more black radical than you thought, that kind of thing. And it's a, you know, scare the white folks in South Carolina message. The Republicans playing the race card. But they don't even have to run the ad on TV. The networks have been all too happy to play it over and over and over again. But anyhow, the point is, Howard Dean, who himself was taken down by Republican hit ads. Remember the Club for Growth came into Iowa in the Iowa primary when Dean was ahead and dropped $1 million on television advertising? Howard Dean, take your latte-drinking, Volvo-driving liberals back to Vermont. And it knocked him out of the race. So he's seen being on the receiving end of Republicans interfering in Democratic primaries, number one. And number two, as the loser, he's seen and understands the importance of going out there and saying, I'm going to support the winner. Will Barack Obama be able to support Hillary Clinton? Will Hillary Clinton be able to support Barack Obama in the general election? Because absolutely, as Howard Dean said, and this is so important, and they need to be thinking this every time they put together a campaign commercial, every time they make a statement on the stump, every time Bill Clinton opens his mouth, or Michelle Obama for that matter, they need to be thinking this, I may have to campaign for that person in the fall. And frankly, you and I have to be thinking about this as well. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It's all good. It's all right. Oh, it's always a good day. When you're glad to be alive, everything I need.
34 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you by you, our listeners. Get to your local radio station. Ask them for a bumper sticker to put in the back seat of your car. Call your sponsors and tell them you're listening. And even if you can't buy their products right now, you'll recommend them to others. And, of course, if you can, pick them up. Let your station know that you're listening. Progressive Talk Radio needs you to be involved. And, of course, we're powered in part by Teamsters for Change. It is time for a change in Washington. You can find out more at Teamster.org. Our phone number, 1-866-303-2270, toll-free nationwide. Actually, internationally, it's not toll-free internationally, but in most countries you can call an 866 number from pretty much anywhere. And our website, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, you'll find links off both. Jim in Marco Island, Florida. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program. Thanks
for
calling.
Hey, Tom, glad to be back on. I can't remember the name of the economist you had on talking about regulation, deregulation, but he sounds more like a priest than a scientist.
Just now, this was that was Dr. Yaron Brook, and he's the head of the Ayn Rand Institute. They've advocated...
Oh, that explains it. But,
yeah, objectivism.
He is more of a priest then.
Well, it is an ideology to a certain extent, and I think he would agree with that. I have a policy of not trashing my guests when they're not around to defend themselves, but I think that I think I can speak for him. You know, we've talked enough times. I think that in any case, your point.
My point is,
they don't have a clue because there's no such thing as a free market. Period. I mean, the closest you can get to it is if I say, I'll wash your car if you'll mow my lawn. That's a pure barter economy just between two people. But even that's not a free market. Because what happens in our society anyway, what happens if after I've made the deal, I'll wash your car if you'll mow my lawn, you discover that my lawn is 20 acres. Or if I'm washing your car and I wreck your car. You know, at that point, then, you've got to have laws. You've got to have, you know, there's got to be a, you know, how do you get remedy if you've been screwed? So, again, not a free market. Okay. Also, to the discussion of whether or not Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama will be able to defend the other after this primary, Charlie in Fort Lauderdale has some thoughts on that. Hey, Charlie, thanks for listening to us on WINS.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. In terms of realpolitik, these characters always reconcile. If you remember Bush, the father, Bush Père, and Reagan, it was very bitter. He called his economic policy voodoo economics.
But that was as far as it got, and that stuck for a long, long time. That hurt Reagan.
He ended up on the ticket with him.
No, I understand that, but that was as far as it got. I don't think the Bush Sr., I remember that election very well. I don't think the Bush Sr. ever said that Reagan wasn't qualified to be president.
When you say that somebody's plan is voodoo economics, that it's smoke and mirrors, even just look a few months ago, Romney and McCain.
But he was speaking of Reagan's policies, not Reagan as a person.
McCain was taking on Romney, saying that basically Romney was just a talking head, you know, that all his privilege had gotten him where he was. I just think the people seem to take it more seriously, the advocates for the politician take it more seriously than the politicians do. I don't think they really hold grudges with this. And if you saw Scalia last night, you realize this delusive, delusional, arrogant man, that we're going to get more of this type if McCain gets in.
Yeah.
I think all the Obama and Clinton fans got to kiss and make up.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why last week on the show, every time a partisan Obama or Clinton person would call in and start trashing the other candidate, I'd say, okay, now you've had your say about that candidate. I'd like to hear you give an elevator speech for the candidate that you oppose. And I was just frankly shocked by the number of people who were either unwilling or unable, mostly unwilling, to do that. And because that's what we're going to have to do. I mean, there's going to come a point sometime in the next couple of months where we are going to have to heal this party. You and I as voters, you and I as citizens, me as a talk show host, the politicians themselves, the party itself. I'm very concerned about talk shows that have gone into the realm of personal vilification of the individual candidates. I'm frankly very concerned about candidates that go into the realm of personal vilification. And I'm very concerned about surrogates who go into the realm of personal vilification. It's one thing to attack a person's policies and say, I think that policy's wrong. It's another thing to attack a person and say, I don't think that person is qualified to be president, or that person is bad, or that person, you know, I wouldn't have sat in that person in that church all those years. That to me falls into the category, I've talked about this before, below the belt. And it's very difficult to back away from below the belt, just like in a marriage. And thanks, Charlie, for your comments. Just like in a marriage or a relationship, when you hit somebody below the belt, it's really, really hard. And sometimes people never recover from that. They always hold a grudge, or they always feel the pain, or there's a scar or a wounding there that is a very, very long-term thing. So, Melinda in Pennsauken, New Jersey. Hey, Melinda.
I was just want to talk about the Reverend Wright, because I didn't know that much about him, although he is from Philadelphia originally, which is 10 minutes from here.
Yeah.
And I watched the Bill Moyers interview the other evening. Mm. Now, I'm a white Episcopalian 65-year-old person, and I was extremely impressed. He's articulate. He's bright. He's intellectual. What is the problem with this man?
The problem is he made one statement which was taken out of context and overblown, and it used an obscenity that is almost parallel to flag burning. And the Republicans are beating Barack Obama up with this. And again, this is where I think inappropriately the Clinton campaign as well has. Just to that point, and thank you, Melinda, for the call and your comments. This is Reverend Wright on patriotism.
Some critics have said that your sermons are unpatriotic. How do you feel about America and about being an American?
I feel that those citizens who say that have never heard my sermons, nor do they know me. They are unfair accusations taken from sound bites and that which is looped over and over again on certain channels. I served 6 years in the military. Does that make me patriotic? How many years did Cheney serve?
Yeah, how many years did Cheney serve?
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Back in the box, Dick. Back in the box. Yeah. I mean, that is the ultimate question. You know, here's Reverend Wright. He was a Marine. He served with Lyndon Johnson. I mean, the guy was giving IVs to Lyndon Johnson because he was a Marine Corps medic. This guy loves his country. Sometimes when you love your country passionately, you passionately criticize your country's bad policies. And that, and as Teddy Roosevelt pointed out, that's the highest form of patriotism. 27 minutes past the hour. Excuse me, 45 minutes past
the Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Six six 303-2270, our number, TomHartman.com. However you spell it, by the way, we'll get you there. Although it is T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's. But nonetheless, I think we have all the misspellings. And AirAmerica.com. That's pretty straightforward. David in Granby, Mass., listening to WHMP. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. It's good to talk to you. I just wanted to expand a little bit on what you were talking about before the break about the loser of the Democratic primary being able to support the winner.
The loser being actually the most important person in the race, because if they don't support the winner will go down in flames.
Yeah, I mean, the Republicans have exactly that experience. And I don't know if you remember the 76 Republican primary between Ford and Reagan.
Right, and afterwards, the conservatives, the whole conservative movement that had lined up behind Reagan, basically walked away from Jerry Ford.
Yeah. Reagan and his supporters sat on their hands and refused to campaign. And I see this more with the Hillary supporters than with the Obama supporters. I think, you know, Hillary Clinton is basically, she's out on a limb and she's busy sawing it off.
Mm. It seems that, I mean, it looks that way to me, and I think that that is probably the source. I mean, good political observers, including some members of Congress, are looking at this saying the only possible explanation for this could be that she's trying to set herself up for 2012 and trying to make sure that Barack Obama doesn't win.
But
I don't personally subscribe to that conspiracy theory, but I can understand where they could derive that from this.
Don't you think that if that's really what she's thinking, that she would be so radioactive, especially if the Democratic Party loses the presidential race this year? Her name will be just so radioactive that nobody will want to touch her.
I think you underestimate how short the memory and the attention span of the American people are. Bill Clinton's comment, you know, some weeks ago that sometimes you have to lose an election to win the next election. This is conventional wisdom in politics. You run, sometimes you run two or three times before you finally get it. Abe Lincoln did, you know, he lost a bunch of elections. I think that there are people who are looking at this and trying to turn it into a conspiracy. I think it's just a badly run campaign. But in terms of, you know, the general election strategy and what's best for the party, and I think that a lot of the superdelegates and a lot of Democrats, and David, thanks for the call, are looking at this going, man, this is not a good thing for the party. Let's fight on the issues. Let's debate it on the issues. Let's, you know, tell me why to vote for you. Don't tell me why the other guy is so bad or why John McCain is better than the other guy. Willie in Gainesville, Florida. Hey, Willie.
Hello.
Hey, what's up?
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to comment. I think the reason why Hillary's able to go so negative is because from the day one, I don't think there was any intention on Barack Obama being the Democratic candidate. If you look at it, how Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, who hates Hillary Clinton, have teamed up with her to make sure that she has the chance to be the nominee, it kind of just tells you they're all in the same club, and Barack Obama obviously is not. And I think the superdelegates are going to make Hillary Clinton the Democratic candidate.
So you think she has it in the bag, and she's known that she's had it in the bag all along, and that's why she's been willing to engage in this kind of campaigning?
Yeah, because I said that even when he won Iowa and he had all this momentum, I told all my friends that he will not be the nominee because America is not ready for a black president. They are more ready for a woman president before a black president. And that was very evident when Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity are fighting so hard for the woman they've been vilifying for the last.
Well, Willie, let me flip that around. If it's true that America is not ready for a black president, but it is ready for a woman president, then you would think that Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity would be arguing in favor of Barack Obama being the nominee because they want the nominee that's easiest to beat. I personally believe that sexism in this culture is more accepted and therefore more destructive, more pernicious than is racism. And that's not to diminish the power of racism at all. It's incredible in this society.
Yeah, I think that it's just people cannot fathom, even Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, they would rather have a woman than a black man. If there's a chance that we're going to have...
No, they want John McCain.
Yeah, they want John McCain, but if John McCain gets beat, they certainly do not want a black man.
No, I think that they are doing what the Republicans have always done. You know, back in the Nixon era, he knew that Ed Muskie could beat him and McGovern could not. And so Nixon went out during the primary and, you know, slipped some acid into Muskie's coffee and he's up on the flatbed truck blubbering. I mean, the dirty tricks. The Republicans have always intervened. Again, the Club for Growth taking down Howard Dean. Howard Dean could have beat George W. Bush in a New York minute. And the Republicans always try to get the weakest candidate for the Democrats. And when Republicans start endorsing, and they are in droves, a Democratic candidate for the convention or for the election, that says to me, Willie, that they think that that's the weakest candidate. I hope that you're wrong and I'm right. Although I will grant that it's entirely possible that you're right and I'm wrong. But I think that America, frankly, is ready for either a black president or a woman president. The question is this the right black candidate? Is she the right woman candidate? And increasingly, I'm thinking that either one of them would make an excellent president. But the way that Hillary Clinton has been running this campaign, if she's not the nominee, is going to be very, very destructive to the Democratic Party. In my personal opinion, it concerns me. Bill in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. Thank you. I'd want to talk about McCain's new populist thing, but I want to hit on your first point about the loser being the most important person. One of the reasons why I think that 30% of Hillary's supporters would not support Obama is precisely the reason that you said earlier. She and John McCain are sort of singing from the same hymn book. And if you notice, Hillary never directly criticizes John McCain by name. And John McCain is a very true politician. He knows that Hillary supporters do not like Obama, so he attacks Obama, and so therefore they're like they're on the same team, and that creates this whole impression that somehow or another, even though we don't agree with all of his positions, he'll be a better alternative than Obama. Now, getting back to the McCain being a populist and this champion for the working class people, and Obama is not. People need to look at the history books to see that McCain voted against the Minimum Wage Act 7 times.
I know. You know what's so incredible about McCain's trip down there? And I got to move along here. I'm sorry. But what's so incredible about McCain's trip down into poor African-American communities is that he is standing in New Orleans, for example, in front of a crowd. John Stewart pointed this out. In front of a crowd of about 1,000 white people. He gets two black people to stand behind him, and what's the AP photo that goes out all over the country? John McCain with the only two black people in the entire crowd. You think that wasn't staged?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. One of the things that, oddly enough, the Democratic and Republican candidates seem to agree on, although they strongly disagree on the solutions, is that the climate is changing and something should be done about it. The IPCC just released a follow-up report. Sea level could rise between 7 and 23 inches by the end of the century. This would flood many South Sea Islands, swamp large parts of Southeast Asia, take out Florida. Some 100 million people live within 3 feet, 1 meter of mean sea level. 100 million people, Louisiana, Florida, and the U.S. especially at risk. Glaciers around the world could melt, causing sea levels to rise, and water shortages, because glaciers are the source of most of the world's major rivers. Over 1 million species face extinction. The Great Conveyor Belt, the ocean circulatory system, could collapse, thus throwing Western Europe into a new ice age. And at some point in the future, we could see a positive feedback loop where where methane in the oceans, the soda pop theory, gets really, really bad. Say goodbye to what? Well, the Center for American Progress, say goodbye to French wines. It's already happening. Bordeaux and other regions are having a challenge. Say goodbye to baseball. The future of the ash tree from which baseball bats are made is in danger of disappearing from beetles and global warming. Say goodbye to Christmas trees. Say goodbye to fly fishing. As warmer temperatures continue to rise, researchers say trout already at the southern limits of the temperature ranges in the Appalachians could disappear there over the next century. Say goodbye to ski vacations. Slopes in the East Coast last year closed months ahead of time due to warm weather. Say goodbye to that snorkeling vacation. The coral are victims of pollution, warmer water, and acidification are dying off. Say goodbye to salmon dinners. Get ready for a lot more chicken. Wild Pacific salmon have already vanished from 40% of their traditional habitats as warmer temperatures in the water are erasing 41% of their habitat. Say goodbye to guacamole. Scientists from Lawrence Livermore say there's a 40% drop in California's avocado production ongoing right now. Say goodbye to mixed nuts and say hello to pretzels. Lots of changes coming. Lena Johansson, Warren T. Brooks Fellowism Journal at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, says, let's just get used to it, don't you, Lenny? Lena?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that sounds like a really scary scenario, and those are the most extreme scenarios.
Actually, everything I just described is already happening.
Yes, because we have been warming for a while.
Yeah.
But these climate changes are natural. We've been through them before. You know, I come from Norway originally, and it might not have French wine, but back in the Middle Ages, we had Norwegian wine, and wine grapes were able to grow in Norway. So these climate changes are natural. They're happening all the time, continually. And I think it's like
10 out of the last 11 years are the hottest years in history.
What did you say, Tom?
I said 10 out of the last 11 years are the hottest years in history. We're seeing an uptick in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and in other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
That is not correct. The Middle Ages was much warmer in Europe, for example, which was why we had the enormous growth in human culture and well-being there at that time.
But not worldwide. We are seeing worldwide changes that haven't been seen in at least 10,000 years. Glaciers vanishing that are 10,000 years old. They didn't go away during the warm period of the Middle Ages.
These measurements from the Middle Ages are taken out of data from the North and South Pole when they're taking out ice cores. So. Global
but I'm saying,
not.
Just look at you know, in Europe, you're from Europe. My grandparent, on my father's side, both my grandmother and my grandfather came from Norway. So I'm kind of familiar with your country. I've spent a lot of time there, and those glaciers actually, you have glaciers only in northern Norway. But if you look at the Swiss glaciers, for example, that you know around Interlaken, for example, that are vanishing. I mean, they're just plain old vanishing. Those did not vanish during the warming of the Middle Ages period.
No, they're vanishing right now because we're down on precipitation. What makes glaciers grow is actually rain and not temperature.
Which is the effect of global warming.
Well, glaciers have been growing in periods where there have been warmer periods also, because warmer periods create more precipitation in the air, which makes glacier warm. But, I mean, let's talk about, is this really the biggest environmental problem that are confronting humans right now?
If it's going to kill 100 million people, I'd say it's right up there.
If you look at the World Health Organization, the top six causes they are listing of environmental problems that are making humans die, they're looking at malaria, malnutrition, unsafe water, indoor air pollution, urban air pollution, and lead poisoning are their top.
Okay, so the top three are again, what?
Malaria, malnutrition, and unsafe water.
Great, let's deal with those one at a time. Malaria. I just came back from Darfur, from the border of Darfur in southern Sudan. The Sudanese government, the Sudanese ambassador to the United States, is saying that one of the reasons, and he's actually correct in this, it's part of a broader kind of misinformation campaign about why they're committing genocide in Darfur. But he is pointing out that desertification, that the deserts are moving south across Central Africa. And as the deserts are moving south, it's pushing the nomadic people, the pastoralists, into the territory of the agriculturalists, the farmers.
Yep.
And that's happening in the northern Darfur region. And there is some truth to that, that the deserts are moving aggressively across Africa. Again, we can see at least four to 5,000 years of history in Africa, of agricultural history, of the region, mostly through the ethnographies that have been done, the studies of language and the studies of culture and who's been where for how long and the DNA testing, some fascinating work that's been done. Those deserts were not expanding during the warm Middle Age period in northern Europe. Those desert, this massive increase in desertification is bringing to regions where I was. There was a clinic in we were in this one refugee camp, 45,000 people. There's a clinic there. Most of the people there had malaria. These are regions that you know, if you went 500 miles south 50 years ago, there was malaria. But these are regions that historically were far enough north and dry enough that malaria wasn't a problem. Now malaria's on the move.
Well, I don't know so much that it's on the move. There's a lot of other stuff that had happened to spread malaria right now. But let's look at malaria. So for every one person I saved from malaria by using the Kyoto Protocol, I could have saved 36,000 by buying bed nets for the same amount of money.
So we should just learn to put up with the mosquitoes that are coming, that are carrying malaria, that are starting to move into North America.
We have solutions against malaria, Tom, and this is where I get back to bashing environmentalists again, even though I consider myself one, but the more traditional ones. Because when it comes to malaria, why is the malaria, why has that been growing again? Because we banned use of DDT. You know, DDT was used to eradicate malaria in America, but you can look at the death tolls in Malaysia, for example, which they were down to 67 cases when they were using malaria or DDT to eradicate malaria. And now they're back up in the millions in their
deaths. And the DDT was causing all of the birds to lay eggs that had no shells and was wiping out huge bird populations. And then the birds eat the insects.
We're also using it in agriculture, but painting the walls of the house with malaria.
You know, I remember as a kid I'm old enough to remember when they sprayed our neighborhoods with this stuff.
Actually, that's what people in Africa and Asia wants to do.
But there
is a difference between doing that, painting the walls of the outside of a house with DDT and spraying it all over our agricultural lands like we did here in America, because all of that...
So let's talk about the number two. Okay, you made your point. And
will cause the Rachel Carson scenario.
Okay, so we need to bring back DDT. Number two, water. You said water is this... Right. Do it sensibly. Okay. So the number two position you said is, you know, the lack of potable water. And I'm sorry, we only have about a minute left.
No, malnutrition was number two.
Oh, malnutrition. Okay, great. Malnutrition, again, being caused by the increasing desertification, the loss of lands, the loss. And we're all over the world, we're seeing the loss of agricultural lands as a result of changes in climate.
Yes.
In Australia, it's huge. In the United States, it's huge.
It's huge. I'm not necessarily thinking that is climate change. We have some drought issues going on because we've been very stupid in how we use water. But if you look at, again, look at the Kyoto Protocol. One of the guys at the Department of the Interior has done some numbers here. And he says that with mitigation following the Kyoto Protocol, we have almost no progress toward the Millennium Development
Goal. Right. I think there's a consensus that the Kyoto Protocol, which our city, Portland, Oregon, has easily met, is nothing. I mean, we've got to go so much farther than that.
But if we do adaptation to climate change, focused adaptation, investment in agricultural development in developing countries, we're going to have a substantial development.
We can make it through. Okay, people can read about it over at lenejohansson.com or cei.org. Lena, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fire it up, fire it up. We push off, we're rolling boulders, crashing down the mirror stairs.
21 minutes past the hour. Say hello to, say goodbye to. What is global warming going to bring? Shall we just adapt to it? Say hello to more mosquitoes. Get ready for more mosquitoes. Mosquitoes like to live in drains and sewer puddles. Long dry spells brought on by higher temperatures turn these nasty stagnant pools into a vital source of water for the mosquitoes. Tasty feast. At the same time, these dry spells reduce the populations of dragonflies, lacewings, and frogs that eat mosquitoes. So the mosquitoes eat us and carry, not just malaria. Now we're looking at yellow fever and dengue fever and breakbone fever. I got inoculated against some of them before I went to Africa, but I'm telling you, there's some you cannot get an inoculation against. Say hello to poison ivy. Increased CO2 levels cause poison ivy to grow taller, lusher, and more resilient, according to the Los Angeles Times. I mean, it's just amazing, all the stuff. You know, say goodbye to guacamole, salmon dinners, lobster dinners, to the wildflowers. It goes on and on. Cannibalistic polar bears, dying polar bears, more bear attacks. The death march of the penguins is instead, emperor penguins have dropped from 300 breeding pairs to just 9 in the western Antarctic peninsula. Because as water's warm and smaller ice flows force the birds to travel farther to find food, they just can't make it. There are areas where the birds are. Say goodbye to the frogs, the Arctic fox, the walrus, the cute koala bears, the jellyfish. It's the cod, birds around the world. I mean, on and on. Should we just adapt to this? I don't think so. I just, you know, for 150,000 people. This is the number of people that the World Health Organization estimates were killed last year by global warming. 150,000 people, heat waves and strokes, Chinese citizens dying, 173 per million every year from ailments related to global warming, death by smog, more heart attacks, more mold, more cholera, Lyme disease. Isn't it time to do something? The genocide in Sudan, say hi to more genocides, say hi to more war in Somalia, say hi to more starvation, say hi to more refugees. No. I don't think so. I really, really don't think so. And where did the hookers go? the Belgian hookers. Say hello to Belgian hooker shortages. Brothel owners in Bulgaria are blaming global warming for staff shortages. They claim their best girls are working in ski resorts because a lack of snow has forced tourists to seek other pleasures with all the time they have on their hands because they can't go out and hit the ski slopes. So, you know, they'll hit something else. Todd in Lawrence, Kansas. Hey, Todd, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great. What's up?
I'd like to play devil's advocate with the people that say it's a natural warming cycle. I don't see how they could, you know, if that's what they believe, how they can actually fly into these major cities and see these clouds hanging over these towns and believe that it's actually helping, you know?
Well, to a large extent, that's not global warming. That's just good old-fashioned pollution. I remember back in the 70s, I was a private pilot, and Louise and I used to fly into Los Angeles from Michigan. And I could, as I was coming down into the city, I mean, it's just this giant orange dome over it. That's mostly gone now because we've cleaned up our cars.
But in other cities in the world, it's even worse. I don't understand how they can make the argument it's a natural cycle. And then if you believe that, that's fine. But actually think that these things are helping helping the cause in any way, you know, that to kind of bypass the whole argument of the.
Well, for a long time they said,
why is pollution good to begin with?
For a long time they said there is no global warming. Then they said, okay, there's global warming, but it's natural. And now they're saying there's global warming, but it's natural. Get used to it. And the subtext to all of it, and not to pick on Lena and not to put these words in her mouth, because I think that she's trying to do this with a lot of integrity. But the subtext to a lot of these folks who are out there saying this is, therefore, just get over it. Don't worry. We don't need to regulate the oil companies, the fuel companies. We don't. God forbid we should have a carbon tax like they have in Sweden, where it costs $140 per ton of carbon dioxide or per ton of carbon that you emit, however you may emit it. And frankly, I think that the big solution to this, I don't even think cap and trade goes far enough. Certainly Kyoto didn't go far enough. I think that we should seriously think in the United States, we should have a good debate about this and a good, honest discussion about replacing the income tax with the carbon tax, replacing the corporate income tax with the carbon tax. Because our economy, I'd say probably 70-80% of our economy, I really don't know the numbers, but I think that that's probably a reasonable guess. It might even be higher than that when you consider all of our sources of energy are carbon-based, with the exception of nuclear power. And even that is mostly carbon-based because you have to use carbon fuels to get the nuclear power, you know, the rods in there and everything else. So much of our economy is based on carbon. Why not tax the carbon? That will push us to move away from carbon.
Yeah, but, and I guess my point being is taking it away from a warming standpoint and turn it into a public health issue as far as air quality in our rivers.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. We need to be talking about the public health aspects of it. Well said, Todd. Thank you very much. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening to WTKG. Hey, Grayson, Jason, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to do a quick panorama of, like, some of your guests today, the first and the last one particularly, how I was kind of shocked and horrified when your first guest said that the situation in Zimbabwe of taking the land, you know, from the colonial land owners and giving it back to the indigenous people was theft. That was basically returning that land back to them, and how, you know, he just kind of said that, you know, people don't have a right to raise crops on their own.
Yeah. It was, and it is, and the problem, and the reason why I didn't get into it with him, because it would have just consumed the whole segment, is that what Mugabe's government failed to do was teach people how to use that land appropriately. There was multi-generational information in the hands of those white landowners that was not, you know, and when small local sharecroppers came in, or small local farmers came in, they didn't have the knowledge base, and the government could have done something about that. Mugabe failed to. And that's a disaster. Jason, thanks for the call.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Oh, ho, ho, it's magic, you know. Never believe it's not so. It's magic, you know.
AirAmerica.com, TomHartman.com, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number here on the Tom Hartman radio program. And Charles in Pompano Beach, Florida, listening on Winds. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, did you say Charles in Pompano Beach?
I did. You're on the air, Charles.
Tom, you're the only one I would wait an hour to speak to.
Well, thank you so much for waiting. I appreciate
it. Okay, Mr. Brooks from the Ayn Rand Institute.
Yes, sir.
I have three bones to pick with him. He claims that the way to solve the world food crisis is to have mega farms using genetically engineered seed.
Right. Technology will save us.
Pardon me?
Technology and laissez-faire capitalism and big transnational corporations will save us.
He specifically said genetically engineered seed.
Right.
First of all, the jury is out, still out on genetically engineered seed and what it may do to the ground, to our long-term health. We don't know what it'll do to us.
Right.
And especially, we don't know what the genetically engineered seed will do in terms of cross-pollination with other plants, especially weeds.
Yep.
It may generate super weeds.
Yeah, and in some cases it appears that it has. Yeah.
Number two point. Centralized mega farms are, on the average, much farther away from the consumers. Therefore, they increase the fuel use and the cost of distribution of their product versus local small farms.
Right.
Also, the food nutritional values decrease with the time and distance that the food has to be transported, so the food that we're getting is not as good as the food that we would get from local farms. Third point is, and perhaps the most significant, there's no guarantee of any cost savings to the consumer because the corporate mission is to maximize profits.
Right, so they're going
to
sell their
long savings.
That's right. They're going to sell their food profit at whatever the market will bear, and that's why I pointed out that there's a lot of speculation right now that there have been a number of speculative bubbles recently in the commodities areas, ranging from gold to oil to now food, that have not to do with supply-demand ratios, but have to do with basically people, you know, big major traders in the commodity markets manipulating commodity markets.
Yeah, especially crude oil.
Yeah, absolutely. And we already know crude oil is not anything close to an open market. You know, it's the Organization Petroleum Exporting Countries, is explicitly a cartel, and we're down to just a handful of oil companies, major oil companies that control the oil supply and gasoline supply and other, you know, fuel oil products supply in the United States, and it's all subject to massive manipulation. But, you know, all of that argues, A, for enforcement, a vigorous and strong enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1881, by the way, which is still on the books. Let's say, you know, it is a felony to engage, to make your company so big that it's impossible for anybody to compete with it, basically, and to move into multiple horizontal and vertical areas of integration in such a way that, that it keeps other people out of the market. And let's start breaking some of these companies up the way that Jimmy Carter broke up AT&T. That was the last time the Sherman Act was, you know, actually used. And it's, you know, Reagan's put an end to it in 81. That led to the mergers. And Charles, thanks for the call. That led to the mergers and acquisition mania of 82 through 86. And Michael Milken and everybody else, you know, all these guys, these M&A experts, right? And it which led directly to the housing crisis of today and to this commodity explosion. The deregulation of the commodity markets in the year 2000, the so-called Enron loophole pushed by Ken Lay, and this was during the Clinton administration, although it was a Republican Congress that did it, and it was very much a Republican approach. That deregulation of commodity markets, I would submit to you, is far more responsible for gas prices. You know, John McCain's running around saying, let's suspend the tax on gas. Yeah, there's, as if the solution to all problems is do away with the tax. Sorry, suspending the tax on gas ain't going to do squat. Taxing carbon will create a huge difference, a huge difference. Brent in Pinyon Hills, California, listening to K-Talk. Hey, Brent, you disagree with me about global warming?
Yes, I do. Thank you for taking my call, by the way.
Certainly. People who disagree with me more often than not go to the front of the line. If it's...
Oh, geez. Well, I'll have to remember that.
There you go.
I tell you why. I've been listening to reading National Geographic for 40 years.
Yep.
And for 40 years, they've been telling me the sky's falling. In the 70s, it was an ice age. Now it's global warming. If it rains, it's because of global warming. If it doesn't rain, it's because of global warming. And my problem I have with the environmentalists, they're very good at pointing out what's wrong, but their solutions, they do more harm than good. I mean, look at your solution. The solution to shortage of food and high gas prices is a tax.
It is replacing the income tax with a carbon tax. It actually would probably be a net tax decrease for the average working person, the average American, because they're not using anywhere near as much carbon as, you know, a large factory or somebody who's living an incredibly wealthy lifestyle with, you know, three yachts and a private jet.
Well, I don't have any of those. But how are you going to tax me? You measure how big my car is or how many miles a year?
That's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I know that Sweden is doing it, and I'm trying to find out how they do it. How do you actually figure out the carbon tax? And in all probability, I'm guessing that you would apply it like a value-added tax. In other words, at every stage of the manufacture of a product, you calculate how much carbon was used for that stage of manufacture, and you tax based on that.
I'm not sure I like a new tax.
What if it did away with your income tax?
I think the solution is to drill more holes in the ground and build more refineries and throw more
carbon dioxide into the air so we get back to the atmosphere we had 600 million years ago during the Carboniferous period?
Make your cars as clean as you can, but this biofuel, you said yourself, it takes 0.7 gallons of gas to make a gallon of ethanol.
Well, I didn't say that, but I think with corn, with the, you know,
right,
the corn subsidies, that's probably true, and I think the corn is a stupid way to make biofuels. I mean, nobody else in the world is doing it except us, and we're doing it because it's politically, you know, because Iowa is one of the early primaries. I mean, you know, let's just, you know, call it what it is. And you know, we need to be looking growing hemp as they're growing for biofuels in Canada, or rapeseed, canola, as they're growing in Europe, all across Germany, you see it. And at the same time, I don't think biofuels is the answer long term. You know, there are much more efficient ways to harvest sunlight than through photosynthesis. We have to develop those technologies.
You know what? I think we agree more than we disagree.
Well, okay, that's good to know. Brett, I mean, you know, the bottom line is, if you're right and there is no global warming, or if I'm right and there is, in either case, if we get together and say, you know, let's get off this carbon addiction and let's figure out, you know, I mean, Iceland is 100% carbon neutral. Of course, they've got a lot of geothermal power there. But you've got a number of the countries in Europe that are down to their, you know, 20, 30, 40% energy independent because they are, A, conservation is the biggest one, and B, they're starting to use things like wind power and solar power. Germany, a third of the houses now have solar panels on them. The faster we move in that direction, the fewer dollars we're sending to Osama bin Laden's buddies.
You know what? And I agree with that. You know where I'm at? We're trying to put in a solar plant, a 500-megawatt solar plant. We can't build it because someone found some ancient footprints that this solar plant is going to cover up. You see what I'm saying about sometimes it's frustrating.
Well, I understand. And at the same time, sometimes we can learn a lot from ancient footprints that might help us in the future. Let's pull them out of that area. Let's excavate it and do it right. Get it all out. Take out all the archaeological stuff of significance, you know, and then build the solar plant, or else build it just down the road. I mean, you know, there has to be a rational middle ground. I agree with you. Brett, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Terry in New Mexico. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Thanks for getting me on. And I want to express a view that I haven't heard from anyone. I'm sure it's out there, but it doesn't matter to me if global warming exists or not. I mean, it does, but to me, the bottom line is you should try and conserve and take care of the things around you and not just have a slash-and-burn attitude.
Yep. Yeah, well said. I mean, this is being good stewards of the earth. This is the bottom line here is that if we can, you know, I think the essential message of environmentalism is the same message as the essential message of most Aboriginal and indigenous societies, which is leave the earth a little better than you found it for future generations. And we're certainly not doing that right now. Fred in Anaheim, California. Hey, Fred.
Hey, Tom, call me crazy, but I think somebody somehow is trying to prevent us from growing our own food. I used to go down to the nurseries and look at nurseries and Home Depot, and I would find dozens and dozens of vegetable plants to bring home and grow myself. And now less than probably 1% of their nursery department is vegetables, and the rest are like flowers.
Yeah.
And
I think it's a cultural conspiracy, Fred, more than anything else. You know, Americans are trying to emulate the British aristocracy of the 19th century and, you know, have lawns to prove that they're so rich that they don't need to grow vegetables. When I lived in Germany, I lived in a little town out in the middle of nowhere, and I'd say 3/4 of all the houses in Steinach, Germany, have a vegetable garden in their front yard. I mean, their entire front yard is producing probably 20% of the food that they eat that year. Whereas when Louise and I moved back to Atlanta, Georgia, we were living in kind of an upscale, you know, suburb in Roswell, Georgia, north of Atlanta. When we moved back, we discovered that if we planted vegetables in our front yard, the local codes, the county zoning ordinances or whatever it was, would have imposed huge fines on us for having something other than grass in our yard. I mean, how crazy is that? We should all be growing gardens in our front yards, our backyards, all over the house. 45 minutes past here. Well said, Fred. Thank you.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Do you know what your fate is? And now you're trying to shake it.
Minutes before the hour, let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com for an update on what's happening in the world today. Hey, Ellen.
Well, the world is a little less pretty place. There was, of course, violence in Gaza again today, and then there's a lot of question about what may be going on in some other areas, such as Iraq. And attacks on the green zone, so that is not terribly pretty. I'm actually right now just finished a briefing at the United Nations, and I'm at the UN Foundation, and we're planning Radio Day that I know you're going to be at, so
yep,
we're excited about that.
I'm looking forward to it. That's the first week of June, right?
That is the first week of June, absolutely.
I will be in New York that whole week.
Well, that's great. On some other issues, a record 2.9% of U.S. homes are not only for sale, they are also vacant. And so we're talking about 2.28 million properties were vacant. And this is the Census Bureau, and they said that U.S. home ownership remained at 67.8%. It's down from a peak of 69.2% in the fourth quarter of 2004. But the issue is vacancy.
Wow. And
you know,
where
there is vacancy, there are big problems, Tom.
Right. So now we presumably are seeing people concentrating in areas of higher population density and lower income, which is a fancy way of saying things like ghettos and poverty areas and shelters and homeless shelters and whatnot. I mean, is that the
SROs? You know, some of these McMansions have serious drug people moving in.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Much of you're a New Yorker. I mean, you know, much of New York City, in fact, most of what are apartments in New York City now, back in the late 19th century, early 20th century when they were built as individual single-family homes. And then the Great Depression hit, and people couldn't maintain their homes. They couldn't pay the taxes. They couldn't pay for them. They got sold off to speculators and landlords who then broke them up into apartments, and many of them are still apartments, and they're in the hands of a smaller number of people. I'm wondering to what extent we're going to see the same thing happen in America, where an entire neighborhood of McMansions that will be, each McMansion will be broken up into a duplex or a triplex or into rooming. I mean, here in Portland downtown, there's all these single-family homes that actually they're renting out individual rooms to young people, you know, and as if they were apartments and things. It'd be a really fascinating economic and sociological phenomena to chart.
It certainly will be. A couple other quick things. Today, Reverend Wright spoke of the prophetic theology of the Black Church, and he made some comments particularly around AIDS and that the U.S. government may, in fact, he said that that the American government, he was asked about the American government inventing AIDS as a way to carry out genocide, and he asked whether he honestly believed that, and he said, have you read Horowitz's book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola? And whoever wrote that question, you must mean medical apartheid. I read different things, and he sort of went on like that. I honestly don't think that his speech at the press club helped the Obama campaign a whole lot. Hillary Clinton is up by 5 now in Indiana, so the party is
interesting. That's just in the last 24 hours it's got to be.
Yes.
That's interesting. But see, Reverend Wright's no longer even his pastor. He's not even the pastor of the church any longer.
No.
That seems to be lost. And nobody is asking who John McCain's pastor is.
We don't even know if John McCain has a regular pastor.
And there's been no discussion of...
I've never met a politician
right.
that didn't.
Yeah, and there's been no discussion of the prayer group that Hillary's a member of that has some a little kind of shaky members.
Exactly. The press is now on this.
Yeah. Oh, my. I am wondering if we're seeing, you know, the Howard Dean feeding frenzy kind of thing going on here where the media decides to just take somebody down and they do it.
I think we're seeing some kind of frenzy. I don't know, but that is that's really very serious. By the way, Karl Rove had a big luncheon at his house the other day before the White House press dinner, and now they're also talking about him in taking a look at whether Karl Rove went after Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney. Went after
mm-hmm.
his dismissal.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, it's everything else he's been involved in.
It wouldn't surprise me at all. Tomorrow I leave actually for Dubai, and we are going to have Richard Miller in Afghanistan. So hopefully he'll be calling into your show. And our
from Afghanistan?
Meredith McKenzie is traveling with the Secretary General this week. Not the Secretary General. The Secretary of Defense this week into Mexico and Texas.
And they'll both be calling into the program?
They're going to try, yes,
wow,
absolutely.
That's great. Okay, Ellen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sounds like a great lineup we've got. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen. Great talking with you. 866-303-2270, Dennis in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Dennis.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Tom, I've written my Congressman Brian Barrett and Patty Murray demanding that the U.S. government fund a Manhattan-type project, get us off of fossil fuels as a fuel of convenience.
Amen.
I don't need 25 miles to the gallon four-seater car to get me to work. I need a pure electric car. It'll go 150 miles at freeway speeds. They're out there. They're being developed.
Yep.
I don't care what it costs. Let's have fossil fuels as a fuel of necessity. That's
well, this is where if we had a carbon tax, those kind of things would happen so fast it would make you, you know, it would, you know, whoa, you know, make your head spin.
It's ludicrous that we're not doing that, that the government will not do it. And how about this, Tom? Oil is a strategic commodity, strategic and necessary to the safety of...
Right. The largest consumer of oil, actually, in the United States, the single largest consumer of oil, is our military. And so we're putting our military at risk by having all of, you know, more than half of our oil supplies coming from overseas. 57 minutes past the hour. Jared Bernstein is going to be in the studio next, talking about the economy.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. Jared Bernstein is in the studio with us. He's the director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute, the author of multiple books, including his new book, Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And Other Unsolved Economic Mysteries. For our listeners in the Portland area, by the way, since we're also live on AM 620 KPOJ here in Portland, he is in town. In fact, he's in the studio with us, and tonight, Tuesday night, rather, he'll be at Annie Bloom's Books talking, giving a presentation at 7:30. And at 7:30 on Wednesday, he will be at Powell's Bookstore on Burnside. So just a heads up to our local folks. And Dr. Bernstein, welcome to the program.
Now, thank you very much, Tom. It's great to be here.
Great to have you with us. Crunch! Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And Other Unsolved Economic Mysteries, your new book. And this is a great primer or primer, I guess, depending on what part of the world you're
from. Yeah, I've never been sure which one is right about that.
I've heard both in different places.
Okay.
But the big squeeze, first of all. Let's look at the kind of macro levels of these, and you can give us the micro take. Why do people feel so squeezed? Why is it that the average person feels like there's something horrible going on in the economy? Why is it that my dad could, you know, raise four kids working in a tool and die shop? And I can't.
Well, actually, throughout the book, I answer people's questions that I took from real people. And that very question is one of them. And I'll speak to that. But the answer, simply put, is people feel squeezed because they are squeezed. And they're economically squeezed in a way that they weren't even a few short years ago. And certainly, families are squeezed in precisely the way you mentioned, in ways that we haven't seen for a few decades. Now, the squeeze really has two dimensions. One is a very short-term dimension, wherein we know that food prices and particularly energy prices, of course, there's a world food crisis, but that's a different, a much more serious issue in developing countries. But here we have food prices and energy prices rising a lot more quickly, both in inflation overall and more quickly than people's paychecks. In fact, I was going to say listeners might not know. Listeners know this probably, but a lot of economists have yet to recognize that real wages, people's actual earnings, have been falling behind inflation now for 6 months in a row.
I thought they've been falling since Reagan became president.
Well, they've been for some people they've been
30 years.
No, for some, well, for the,
on
the,
average,
the median male, and this gets right to your question from a second ago. If you look at the typical male worker, right in the middle of the wage scale, the median male, his wage in 2007 was almost exactly the same to the penny when you adjust for inflation to his wage in 1973.
If you compared 73 with 53, there was a huge difference.
It's probably the single most important indictment of the lack of broadly shared prosperity.
Isn't that a fancy way of saying it's the single largest indictment of Reaganomics? Because that's what we've been operating under for 30 years.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, it is, but it's occurred over regimes both left and right. And this is not simply something that happens under Republicans, doesn't happen under Democrats. This is a structural problem that actually goes beyond who's in the White House. But I agree that that this kind of, what I actually referred to in an early book as yo-yo economics. You're on your own economics. The idea that government really has no role to play in any of these problems absolutely is at the heart of this.
Yeah.
This
so people actually are squeezed. Don't know much about GDP, unemployment, Wall Street versus Main Street. Why is it that when companies lay off workers, their stock goes up?
Right. Well,
why is it that the worse
I
things
see that,
get,
you know,
the more corporations are going, hey, we're more profitable.
You know, I see that. I see it on a monthly basis, by the way. I work in Washington, D.C., and one of my jobs is to follow the markets and to follow the government reports on this and that. And when the unemployment rate goes up, when we get one of these unemployment reports and the unemployment rate spikes up, a lot of times Wall Street starts popping the champagne corks and saying, great, unemployment's up. That means the Fed doesn't have to raise rates. The Fed can lower. We can get into the details.
Well, in 96, Greenspan said to the Wall Street Journal that he saw his job as adjusting interest rates to prevent wage inflation and maintaining a certain, quote, minimum level of worker insecurity.
And one of the things I detail in Crunch is precisely what a biased approach to economic policy it is, what a class bias is inherent in that. I mean, it's probably obvious to our listeners, but it's unfortunately not as obvious as it ought to be to policymakers. Look, I think to get to answer your question, there is an obvious huge gap, both in the distribution of wealth or income, but in the interests of different groups within our economy. I mean, you can talk about a capital versus labor. You can talk about Wall Street versus Main Street.
Well, you know, just in a very real sense, just at the level of the average person on the street, I'm old enough to remember growing up in Lansing, Michigan, two statewide papers, the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News. One had a labor section. The other had a business section. One was reliably supporting Democratic candidates. The other was reliably supporting Republican candidates. The labor sections that used to be in newspapers, or the labor pages that used to be in newspapers all over the United States in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even the early 80s have been gone since about the middle of the Reagan presidency.
Right.
They have been gone.
No, that's right. And part of that is symptomatic of a key shift in economic policy. It gets right to your question about layoffs and why Wall Street celebrates. The key strategy among corporate America for growing your profits, growing your industry, growing your corporation has been twofold. One is to, and they're both related, one is to globalize, and the other is to cut labor costs. Cut labor costs at all costs. If you cut labor costs, if you lay people off, if you lay everybody off to the bone, such that any, you know, Warren Buffett-type pragmatic investor would look at your perspective and say, boy, did you just shoot yourself in the head, Wall Street will go out and celebrate because you are lean and mean. You're cutting labor costs. It's the most short-sighted approach
that's
exactly where we are today.
Right, and this is how Mitt Romney made all his money.
It's
called pump and dump. You know,
pump and dump.
Strip them down and sell them off.
So we now have a system that elevates the Romney-esque pump and dump, cut labor costs at all costs, completely ignoring what is so obvious to all of us, which is that you can't run an economy like that for more than 5 minutes without getting exactly to where we are.
Right, and you end up then wiping out your middle class, which is your cash cow,
exactly,
because they're the consumers.
See, what you and I are talking about right now is not, this is not like left-wing redistributed. This is basic efficiency economics.
We're talking common sense.
This bingo.
Jared Bernstein, the author of Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And Other Unsolved Economic Mysteries. He's with the Economic Policy Institute, by the way. EPI.org is the website. You have a section in the book, Political Economy. I think we've, to some extent, been talking about that. But you also get into the world isn't as flat as all that. I have for a long time been saying that Thomas Friedman, in as much as he's the heir to Milton and to Friedrich von Hayek, is nuts. I'm sure you're more diplomatic than I am, but the world ain't flat.
Right. I cite in a few sentences, I cite the aspects of Friedman that I agree with, and then I spend many pages elaborating that the parts I don't, and very much rejecting his, I think, breathless kind of evaluation of all this stuff. In fact, I cited something in the book that I think I borrowed from Eric Alterman, where he goes to hear Thomas Friedman speak, and Friedman says, you know, I love the Caribbean Free Trade Agreement. So he gets, first of all, it's the Central American, so he gets the name wrong. Right. And then someone says, well, what's in it? Have you read it? He says, no, I haven't read it. He said, but it says Free Trade Agreement on the title, and I like it. So, I mean, this is a guy.
Like the Patriot Act.
Bingo.
You've got to be patriotic.
This is a guy with some of the most primary intellectual real estate in the country, and he's saying, I like this. Don't have to read it.
Well, he's also a guy worth $3 billion. And I think that people who are in that top 0.1% understand that when these kind of bamboozlings of the American public are being done, it's going to benefit them.
So, but getting into the content, though, I begin that chapter on globalization by examining some of the benefits, the upsides, primarily in terms of lower prices. Then I spend a lot of time investigating the downsides. And the Friedman-esque cheerleaders would have us believe that trade is all up and no down. Everybody knows that's wrong.
Right.
And so what we need to do is wrap our heads around the downsides and figure out how to tap the benefits of the upsides to offset the downsides.
Right. And nobody has pointed out, you know, I'd be willing to pay more for the stuff at Walmart if my paycheck is 20% bigger.
Right.
30% or
50%. Oh, I absolutely stress that this idea that you can somehow have this horse race between prices and wages as your economic strategy,
right,
it's not going to work.
We're talking with Jared Bernstein. We have about 20 seconds left. What's the good news? How do we fix this?
The good news is that we have a highly productive economy. Now, that productivity growth hasn't reached those the vast majority of, say, the bakers who are baking that bigger pie. We need a government that's competent and able to help reinvest the benefits of growth into folks that growth has been bypassing for far too long.
We need to hire some politicians who realize that Reagan was crazy. Or that Reaganomics really was voodoo economics. That George Herbert Walker Bush was right, although he nonetheless had to keep going down that road. It's a tragic thing. Jared Bernstein, for those folks who are local here in Portland, he'll be at Annie Bloom's tomorrow night and Powell's day after tomorrow. His new book, Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed? And Other Unsolved Economic Mysteries, EPI.org. Thanks, Jared.
My pleasure, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Congressman Keith Ellison, representing the 5th District of Minnesota, is on the line with us, the Democrat from Minnesota. And first of all, welcome back, Congressman.
Hey, Tom. How you doing, buddy?
I'm just doing well. It is always great having you on the program. I'm a big fan of yours. You're doing great work in Congress. And there was this absolutely outrageous. This is every week we do a labor segment in this time period. Now, I wanted to get you on to talk about what happened, mostly in the Senate, actually, but, you know, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, the Congressional Black Caucus got together and said, we need to tip our hat to Cesar Chavez.
That's, you know, right.
And it seems that there was a group of people in Congress who said, ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
Tell us the story.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, a number of Republicans in the Senate got together to block it, you know. You know, the fact is that, you know, the Senate has rules which require a certain percentage, just about 60%, to bring something up. Otherwise, they can just block stuff. And they exercise that prerogative to make sure that Cesar Chavez, who isn't just a Hispanic leader or a person of color leader, but actually is a leader for labor rights, for people of all colors.
Mm-hmm.
Just said this great American will not be able to get any honor from the Congress.
Now, this was just a simple resolution, wasn't it? Marking Chavez's 81st birthday on the 31st?
That's all. Just a resolution. But you know what? It really just sort of points to the fact that when you're talking about increasing opportunity, economic justice, when you're talking about empowering people who really do the hard work and make America go, that some of our friends in the Republican Party just have no sympathy or identification with him. I mean, you know, John McCain at one time voted against MLK.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm going to say this in a way that probably you're too diplomatic to say, but you can tell me whether you think that I may have a sense of this right. I mean, by
let her rip.
The Republicans filibustering a resolution to simply honor Cesar Chavez's 81st birthday on March 31st is part of their anti-immigration strategy, which is really part of essentially a let's appeal to the white racists and scare them about, oh, my God, the brown people are coming strategy.
Yeah, that's what it's about. See,
it's the racism stupid is the bottom line.
Yeah, well, and that's the second from the bottom line in my thinking. The bottom line is he doesn't want any solidarity between American workers of diverse colors.
Among Latinos and African-Americans in particular.
Or whites,
yeah, absolutely.
No, he doesn't want any. He doesn't want Joe Jablonski, who is a worker in Taylor, Michigan, lining up with Jose Murillo in Texas,
right?
And getting together and being brothers and saying, "Let's you and I make sure we can get a fair wage."
Yeah, because
the
only way the Republicans can ever win an election is by dividing people against each other.
Right. They stand opposed to human solidarity. We stand in favor of it. You know,
amen.
That's us. That's them. You know.
There you go. We're talking with Congressman Keith Ellison of the 5th District in Minnesota, and his website, by the way, ellison.house.gov. And Congressman, if I can change the subject just for a moment, we only have about 2 minutes here left. But you're the only, as far as I know, the only member of Congress who's a Muslim.
Nope, there's two of us now.
Oh, there's two of you now. Okay, great. No, but I remember when
Julia Carson passed away, God, you know, rest in peace, and her grandson, Andre Carson, was elected from Indianapolis just about a month ago.
Well, that's great. So we have two members of Congress. But I remember when you first came in, the right wing just went, you know, hysterical. In fact, we had you on this program talking about it. And there is a cottage industry that has sprung up over the last few months of people sending out emails to particularly right-wing listservs, but I'm getting them all the time and people send them to me, basically suggesting that the things that you did, in other words, being sworn in
for the photograph
with your hand in the Quran, was actually Barack Obama trying to conflate his middle name, Hussein, with your Muslimness as if that's some terrible thing.
Yeah.
And again, appealing to the racists as well as to the Islamophobes. I don't know what the word is.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on that, sir.
Bigots works fine. Yeah, well, you know, the thing about it is that these people are wrong if they believe that Americans are, in general, bigoted people. You know, we've had a momentous civil war, which ripped the country apart, then a civil rights movement. And, you know, yes, there are bigots. There are people who don't believe in human solidarity. But the overwhelming majority of Americans do. These kinds of divisive tactics are not going to work, Tom. They're just not. People are smarter than they used to be, but we can't leave the work of building cultural understanding and fighting for racial justice. We can't just leave it to the side. We got to continually work on it. So, you know, we got to work in it in our faith communities. We've got to work in it on the shop floor.
Yeah, amen. And pass card check. And
you got
let's
it.
Rebuild
you got
these
it.
Unions.
We got a pass card check.
And roll back Taft-Hartley.
And they're afraid to death of that, and we're going to do it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I see it coming. I absolutely see it coming, and it is so great to have progressive members like you representing us in the United States House of Representatives.
When's the next book coming, Tom?
This fall.
Hey, man, I'm going to read it, man. You let me know.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota's 5th District, his website, ellison.house.gov. Congressman, thanks so much for being
with us.
It is just doing some great work in the United States House of Representatives. 27 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 866-303-2270. TomHartmann.com for our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for the blogs and things over there. We'll be back with your calls and more news of the day right after this.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see. So I won't be afraid, no, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by me.
And stand by your local radio station. Stand by your advertisers, our sponsors. and the party. Let's get out there and take this country back. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Is it Arnold in Columbia, South Carolina, listening to WOIC?
Yes, I am.
Hey,
I just wanted to say that this isn't the first time that the powers that be drive a wedge between poor and working whites, blacks, and other races to divide and conquer. That was the way they effectively ended Reconstruction, was by making poor whites think that blacks were somehow a threat to them. It was in 1867 that a majority black legislature in South Carolina created the first free public schools that we ever had, and it was a fully integrated school system which not only educated free blacks, but also poor whites who had never had an opportunity to go to school. And it wasn't until populist racists like Ben Tillman convinced white farmers that somehow black sharecroppers were a threat to them that he was able to push through the racist Constitution of 1895.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that South Carolina had been that the legislature was dominated by African Americans that early.
Yes, it was.
And to what extent, given your knowledge of the history of that area and that time, to what extent do you think that the Grange movement, which you know in large part was that populist farmer movement, it was largely a white movement, as I recall from the history that I read of it. To what extent do you think that the Grange movement was a pushback on that, or was a racist movement, or was it more just a purely populist movement?
I'm not really very knowledgeable about the Grange, but I know
that was
Ben
the organized
Tillman,
farmers, you know, the farmers' unions.
Well, I know Ben Tillman got the name Pitchfork Ben because he was appealing to white farmers, and they called him Pitchfork Ben supposedly because he threatened to put a pitchfork through Rutherford Hayes if he ever came to South Carolina.
The president.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. Arnold, thanks for the history lesson.
All right, thank you.
I always love history lessons. 866-303-2270. CJ, listening on Green 960 in San Francisco in Oakland, California. Hey, CJ.
Hi, Tom. I was just wondering, when is somebody from the media or a talk show host going to stand up to dispel the imbecilic notion of a war on terror?
Well, I think I've done it 40, 50 times in the last couple months. I mean, I'll be the first to say, A, I'm not afraid. You know, if you want to be afraid of something, consider that there is a group of men, there's a group of seven men in the United States who were dragged before Congress and all raised their hands and lied under oath, a group of seven men who are responsible for the death of more than 500,000 Americans every year. These are the executives of the tobacco companies. You want to be afraid of dying in this country? 500,000 people a year die from smoking. I am not afraid of the terrorists. I am not going to give up my liberties because they were successful in one of their, you know, I don't mean to diminish the trauma that was experienced by the people in New York City, but nonetheless, I'm not afraid of Tim McVeigh and the right wingers just because they successfully blew up a building in Oklahoma City. I am just not going to live my life in fear. I agree.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
Well, George Bush has said the exact opposite. This is just a montage of little clips, chopped up pieces from his speech in 2004 before the Republican National Convention.
Yeah. Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists, danger, doomed killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy. May God bless you, evil God. Iraq, darkness, the continuing danger.
I mean, that goes on for 2.5 minutes, you know. I mean, it's just, nothing but be afraid, be afraid.
And that's the idea, is to keep people terrorized, but terrorists around the world, terror is a tactic. It is not a country or a nation.
Terror is
the poorest people on earth employ the tactic of terror because they are powerless against the wealthy nations of the world.
Yeah, we used to call it asymmetric warfare.
Unless you're going to end poverty, there's going to always be terrorism. But to try to have a notion of war on terror, that's imbecilic, and we'd be fighting forever if that's what they're trying to do.
No, it's a rhetorical device like the war on poverty or the war on drugs, and which are equally stupid.
Yeah.
And, very well said, CJ. Thank you very much for the call and for giving me an opportunity to get back to one of my very favorite rants. Toby in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Toby.
Hi.
Hi. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi.
What's up?
Tom, great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I just want to throw this out there that I believe that the reason why Hillary's still in the race is because she's seriously in debt, and that Obama has agreed to do fundraisers and a joint venture with the DNC, and I believe that they're going to retire her debt.
You know, that may well be when all is said and done if she's not the party's nominee, but I'm not quite so conspiracy-minded, Toby. I am of the opinion that Hillary thinks that if she can stay in the race long enough, that Barack will make some fatal mistake, that he will stumble and fall, and she'll be the one left, the only one left standing. And frankly, I think that that's her only hope right now. Although, you know, Ellen Ratner just said, you know, she's up 5 points in Indiana, a strong victory in Indiana. You know, they're fighting for the hearts and minds of the uncommitted superdelegates. And
Indiana won't vote for a Democrat anyway.
Well, yeah.
Solidly red state.
But tell that to the Clinton and Obama teams. I mean, you know, it's we'll see how it shakes out. Toby, thanks a lot for the call. It's an interesting concept. The Tupac in Phoenix, Arizona, listening to KPHX. Hey, Tupac. You're on the air. Oh, you're not on the air. Okay, you're not there. Deborah in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Deborah.
Hi, Tom. Sorry, I've been listening so long on the speaker. Anyway.
No, that's quite all right. Thank you for being so patient. What's up?
The first comment that I want to make is, number one, God and Jesus are not running mates. I'm sick of this.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
The next thing that I'm tired of is that basically all of this Reverend Wright stuff is blaming or working against Obama by proximity.
Yep. Okay. Well, it's not just that. It's not just proxy or proximity. It's also trying to associate him with a part of the black culture that is frightening or intimidating to people in the white culture who have never had exposure to the black culture.
Okay, I can understand that. But the one thing that, I mean, it appears to be the wonderful divisive portion of the Republican machine.
Oh, absolutely.
When it comes to, is that they do everything they can to look away from the simple things that are in their closet that could cause problems. And the
sure.
reason that I'm talking about that is a book that was written called The Plot to Seize the White House. Okay.
Are you talking about the coup against Franklin Roosevelt that was planned
right.
in 1934?
And the fact that the current sitting president's grandfather was part of that coup.
Yeah. Yeah, it is not often mentioned, the Prescott Bush's, Brown Brothers Harriman, you know, it being the fact of the matter is that once Roosevelt found out about it, you know, through the good graces of Smedley Butler, once Roosevelt found out about it, he basically quashed any investigations into it because he didn't want the word to travel. Most Americans don't even know that it happened, but you're right. There have been several books written about it. And it is an important chapter in our history. I mean, there was actually, forget about assassination attempts, this was a coup attempt. And they were quite serious, and it was funded by some of the most powerful bankers, mostly, on Wall Street. And there was a small possibility they could have been successful. Alan in Portland. Hey, Alan.
Yes, sir. Thank you again for the show. Comment concerning the progressive tax.
You mean
the carbon tax?
Carbon tax. Yeah.
Here's a suggestion. I'm a pilot as yourself and have flown over the state of Oregon for decades now. This is a large state, and a mileage tax is not going to fly for western states. What I suggest
right.
is a cubic inch engine tax on all internal combustion engines, from aircraft engines to diesel engines, automobile engines, marine engines. So when it comes time to re-register to get your tags, whatever your cubic inch of your engine is, you get taxed on that.
Or the mileage.
Not the mileage, no.
Why not?
Well, I'm from southern Oregon, and I have friends out in eastern Oregon, and when you've got to travel 30, 40, or more miles one way to go to the store, that is just too much of a tag on people.
No, I understand. No, I don't mean mileage driven. I mean the gas efficiency, because with hybrid engines and plug-in engines and things like that coming down the road, there are going to be vehicles that will have, you know, fairly large engine blocks, 4 and 6 cylinder engines,
that
have an electric motor in them, and they can plug them in and then get 70, 80 miles to the gallon.
Right, but that's going to take a while for those type of cars to filter down to the folks that are making less than $20,000 a year.
I agree, but it may be a whole lot sooner than you think.
Well, the other problem is these automobiles today. I used to work in a parts department for an automobile dealership, and these cars are designed to only last so long. by the time these hybrid electrics finally filter down to the individuals that can afford a car that's worth maybe $1,200 or $1,500 or less, these things will not have the life left in them, and then who knows what it's going to cost to replace these batteries that goes in these cars. Individuals who are making minimum wage are not going to be able to replace batteries in these things.
Yeah, I remember the first hybrid I had was a Honda Insight, and instead of having one giant battery like they do in the Prius, they had tubes that look sort of like fluorescent bulbs, and inside those tubes were basically D cells. And I don't know if they're NiCads or lithium ion or what, but they were these D cells. And so you could replace the individual batteries when they went bad. It seems like a much more economical way to do it. But you know, there's a lot we can do with technology. 45 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Before the hour, strange stuff going on out there in the world. I'm telling you, it's downright crazy. Florida pawn shop owners say the high price of gold has led to a mass influx of people seeking to sell their gold teeth, dental caps, filling, and bridge work. Pawn shop proprietor said that while in previous years they would occasionally encounter people seeking to sell their gold teeth, the number of customers seeking cash for their dental work has skyrocketed. It's mostly bad economy, partly high price of gold, but whatever it is, it's crazy. John in Portland, Oregon. Hey, John.
Hello.
Hey.
I have two comments about things that were talked about earlier on your show.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that there's a basic misunderstanding about what global warming is. That the actual term was coined back in the 70s, and it was global climate change. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything's going to get warmer.
Right.
It could mean that things will change and weather patterns will change.
Well, if the North Atlantic Current shuts down, Europe could be thrown into an ice age in the midst of all this.
Absolutely. The science, the pop science that was exposed in the movie The day after, or the,
yep.
That was actually based on true events that have happened, and it's recorded in history in the geological record.
Yeah, the last time it happened, or the last time the current started itself back up was 11,000 years ago, and it ended the last ice age.
Right, and if anyone wants to read a really fascinating book on some of the effects of that, read Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock. Mm-hmm. The second thing that I'd like to say is that I believe that the U.S. military is building these huge bases in the Middle East simply to gain control of the oil supply there so that they can perpetuate their control over the smaller countries in the world. And that's really the whole reason why we're in Iraq, and eventually we're going to go into Iran.
Yeah, I cannot argue with that statement, John. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Gary in Miami listening on Wins. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Tom. I got a couple comments. Number one, the more I hear Reverend Wright speak, such as on Bill Moyer's show and on CNN last night, the more I like him, the more I respect him, and the more I respect Barack Obama for going to his church.
Yeah, I think Ellen's comments about his taking a question about AIDS and it, you know, probably now being taken out of context, and now the bloviators are going to be saying Reverend Wright's saying that AIDS is a white conspiracy or something. Setting that aside, which may be difficult to do, he comes across and is obviously a patriot, a Marine, a very well-educated man, a very thoughtful and introspective man, and frankly, a man very committed to his faith and to the people, not just in his community, but in the entire United States of America.
I think he cares a great deal about mankind.
Yeah, yeah. And let's, you know, for the record, also note that the church that he's the pastor of is not just an African-American church.
That's right.
It has a substantial white population, substantial Latino population as well.
And, you know, I see such a tremendous divide nowadays between the haves and the have-nots in this country, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, et cetera. I think that we might be seeing the beginning or the foundation of a civil war?
I think we're seeing the end of it, Gary.
Really?
Yeah, I really do. There was a thing on Huffington Post yesterday about how Vogue is now starting to show black models, how it's now fashionable to be black. I think that what is happening is that America is becoming more multicultural. It is becoming more multiracial. We're more accepting of differences. Like, for example, we've got a couple of states now where there's either civil unions or gay marriage, and it's just not even an issue anymore. It's like, hey, okay, big deal. I remember when the civil unions were passed in Vermont, and everybody was, all the right-wingers were going, this is going to destroy the state. It didn't. It actually brought some tourism in. That was about it. I think that, frankly, America's waking up. And what you're seeing in the media, the stuff that's being really pushed and hyperbloviated and waving around, the Pat Buchanans of the world, who I heard speak in Atlanta, by the way, when he was running for president back long ago and far away. This was in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, whatever year it was he ran for president. I was living, my family and I lived in Atlanta. We took our kids to hear him speak because we said, if Hitler was giving an early speech in the 30s, we'd want you to know what he had to say. And honest to God, Pat Buchanan got up on that platform, and I would say at least every third or fourth sentence was those people. He kept referring to those people. He referred to the international bankers, which was, code for those Jews. He kept referring to those people who want to take your jobs, which was code for those Hispanics or those African Americans. The audience was 100% white. Most of the security guys were skinheads. I mean, it was one of the most bizarre and frightening things that I've ever experienced. And Louise, my kids were with me. We were just absolutely shocked. And I'm just astounded that, given that history, that, he's on TV every day. I mean, it's like, wow, this guy is about as, but I think that he's moderated and softened over the years because America has. I think that we're moving in the right direction. Gary, I got to move along. I'm sorry. We only have a minute here left and I want to get a couple more callers in. Tupac in Phoenix. Let's try it again, Tupac.
Hello, Tom. Last time I talked, I think it was before we had achieved the passage of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples back in September. I hope we can still get some programming on your show related to that issue.
That's a good suggestion. Thank you.
But I wanted to mention today in the discussion on race and racism and the interrelationship between the European Americans and the rest of the populations, not only in the U.S., of America, but America as a whole, meaning the continent. Mm-hmm. I think one of the concepts is that in the terminology, we haven't clarified the concept of white people. It's used all the time in the media.
Yeah. Tupac, you're bringing up an important point, and it deserves more time than we have right now because we're flat out of time. It's the end of the show. But give me a call sometime a little later in the week, and let's get into this. Let's spend 2 or 3 minutes actually digging into it. Thank you very much for your call. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Ronnie Deutsch of the Ronnie Deutsch Tax Center about her opinion of which presidential candidate has the best plan for taxes and the economy. I think she likes McCain. This will be interesting. And I'll be exposing the dirty tricks of Karl Rove of the Bush administration with a man who's been at the center of the Republican hit storm, Governor Don Siegelman, who's going to be with us. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.